Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. The thread question of the week is coming up later. Now in depth on liberals' opportunities lost. The wilderness that Democrats are wandering in after losing the White House, majorities in Congress, and don't underestimate this, control in many state legislatures may not seem so wild after all. Donald Trump appears to have given them a compass. In a recent column for The Guardian of London, Thomas Frank cheers the resistance marches and the raucous Republican town halls and says, "The two are the healthiest political developments I have seen in years." But he doesn't spend much time celebrating. Frank, who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, is worried that what he calls Enron Democrats will hijack the outpouring of lefty ferocity and avoid the much-needed soul-searching the party so desperately needs. As Thomas Frank joins us, I want to hear from you on that soul-searching. If you're a Democrat or an independent, what kind of change must be made within the party to reinvigorate it? Are you concerned that opposing Donald Trump will distract from the search for a new vision that Democrats should undertake? So I'm asking you in that part of the question whether being the opposition to Donald Trump is enough. Is it the shiny object that distracts the party from really doing some internal soul searching for a new vision? I'd love to hear from you on this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Thomas Frank is a political writer, the author of Listen Liberal. That's his new book. And he joins me in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
How are you today, Kerry?
You chuckled when you heard me use this phrase, Enron Democrat.
Yeah, I forgot. Why? I wrote that.
Well, that's fairly recent.
Fail Democrats, you know, Democrats who deliver failure. And I just forgot that I had come up with, I like metaphors. You know?
What's the definition of a failed or an Enron Democrat?
Well, look at where we are. You mentioned the matter of state legislatures. Since 2008, they've lost something like 1,000 seats in the state legislatures of America. This is a party that is in a state of historic wipeout. I mean, they're in the weakest situation they've been in since the 1920s, you know. And this is a party that, and it's hard for people to believe today. When I was young, until the 1990s, they always controlled Congress, always, because they were the party of the people. This was their brand identity, and it was golden. I mean, it was a really good brand identity. It's also sort of who they were. And that disappeared. They lost that in the mid-90s and have never really recovered it. And it is astonishing to me that we are heading into this age. It's not astonishing. We're going to explain everything in this hour.
Are we?
But you bet we are.
Is 1 hour long enough to do that?
No, I can do it. Okay. I can do it, man. All right, I'll talk real fast. But we are heading into, Kerry, and you know this, into this age of epic inequality in this country, where inequality is out of control and everyone can see it. And, you know, the middle class is crumbling, you know, the farm economy is crumbling, you know, manufacturing. You go right down the list. And what we call the party of the left in our system, I mean, they're not much of a left party, but that's what we got. They can't seem to make any headway with this. They lose and they lose and they lose and they lose. And all the sort of energy and all the rebellion and all the anger is captured by the right wing in this country. And that is I've been writing about this phenomenon for a long time, and it just gets worse. Every couple of years, it gets worse and worse and worse.
Congress and the president get a lot of attention from my show, from journalists, from policy wonks. A lot of Americans pay attention to that. I don't think we ought to overlook the meaning of what you've just said about state legislatures. Losing a lot of governor's seats, losing, including here in Minnesota, losing majorities in state legislatures. Those losses might affect the everyday lives of people in this country more than what happens in Congress. Is that arguable, or would you agree with that?
Sure. Yeah. Of course, I have no reason to argue with that. But I would point you to the larger question that I was raising, which is, you know, what has allowed this to happen? And, you know, Carrie, you know that for years I've written books about the conservative movement and about right-wingers and about the sort of the things that they do to, you know, what's the matter with Kansas? This is that's what it's about. It's like, how does the conservative movement build how does it have a populist appeal? How does it appeal to working class citizens? And then the new book, Listen Liberal, asks the opposite question. How did the Democrats fritter this away? And the answer is, you remember how a minute ago I referred to them as the party of the people, or that's what their brand identity used to be. And they simply aren't that anymore. They really are the party of an affluent, you know, well-educated, white-collar professional class. That's how they see themselves. That's who controls the party. You know, they see a fundamental kinship between themselves and Wall Street. It's not just, you know, they want Wall Street's money. They see these people as peers. The same with Silicon Valley. The same with Big Pharma. You go right down the list. This is a party that our supposed party of the left in America is simply not, you know, interested in what a traditional party of the left is supposed to care about.
So when you just describe well-educated, affluent, white-collar,
yeah,
I'd say those people need representation too.
Is it, yeah, that's right. Of course
is it
they
impossible?
Do.
Is it impossible though to serve perhaps and be aware of those interests, even as you don't lose the core of who once made up the party?
Of course, that's possible, but that's it not is what, possible. That's, to not, do but that. That's not what's happening.
And why?
Because these people are, like everyone else, are more concerned with their own interests and their own worldview than they are with that of working class people. And this is, by the way, a long transition in the Democratic Party that's been going on since the late 60s. And it's not a secret, Carrie. They've written about this ever since this started. I mean, this began back in the late 60s, and it has progressed and progressed. And today, this process is pretty much complete. And so you have in America, you have the Republicans, which are and have always been a business party, a party concerned with big business and small business. And then you have the Democratic Party, which is today a party concerned with the professional class, you know, the needs and wants and desires and fantasies of the professional class. And the working class is just – it's like a game of musical chairs. You have three classes and two parties. These guys are left out. And they have to squeeze themselves back in however best they can. And you watch them going for someone like Trump.
I was just going to say, I mean, the way they squeezed – they thought they were squeezing back
in. Well, that was
his
strategy.
Through Donald Trump, right?
And do you think Donald Trump is going to help these people out? It seems unlikely to me. But a lot of working class people stayed with the Democratic Party, but they aren't too enthusiastic about it. They can see that neither party is really concerned about their interests. But these days – and this is the crazy thing, Carrie. I mean – it is guys like Donald Trump that do a much better job of pretending to care about the problems of these people.
You know, this does sound somewhat apocalyptic for the Democrats, what you're saying. But let's remember that in 2000
yeah.
– hold on. Let's remember yes. In 2008, a Democratic president was elected. He served two terms. He had Democratic majorities for 2 years.
That's right.
And then that wasn't that long ago.
No, that's right. And I was one of those people who was, you know, I thought – by the way, this is the starting point of Listen Liberal is the Barack Obama administration. I thought in 2008, I thought he was my generation's Franklin Roosevelt. You know, we were in this financial crisis, the Great Recession. Wall Street had poisoned the economy of the entire world. And here comes Barack Obama. You couldn't ask for, a more intelligent, a man who knew what he was doing or seemed to know what he was doing, and his incredible eloquence. I was extremely enthusiastic. And he basically, on the most important question of the day, which is what to do about Wall Street, the most important question of 2008, he essentially continued the policies of George W. Bush, you know, with regards to the bank bailouts. So the way I like to put it is that, yes, we came to a turning point in 2008 and we didn't make the turn.
So Barack Obama is one of those Enron Democrats that you talked
about.
Well,
I have a little higher regard for him than I do for, say, Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton. These are characters that I dislike. Bill Clinton, Hillary, you know, at the end of the day, I vote for these people. And I know a lot of Democrats. I live in Washington. I live in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. Everyone is a Democrat. And by the way, everyone is an affluent, white-collar, you know, Ph.D., you know.
Including you. Are you a Ph.D.?
I am.
Yeah, see.
I fully admit I'm part of the group that I criticize. I'm part of the group that I criticize. But so the book starts with an effort to answer that burning question about the Obama administration. How, when they're faced with this world historic opportunity, the entire world was behind Barack Obama. It was the moment to turn away from a failed, you know, philosophy, this sort of free market religion that we had been, that the, you know, neoliberalism is what they, we call it in academia, or they call it. I'm not in academia anymore, but to turn away from this philosophy. And it was, this was up to Barack Obama, and he didn't do it. And now you have a guy like Donald Trump, who is in some ways a similar figure. I mean, I don't want to push this analogy too far, but
a similar figure to who?
Obama? In the sense that he is, well, the change thing. But whereas Obama was all about hope, and I was into the hope, Trump is about desperation. This is people who are watching their way of life crumble. And, you know, I know, and I'm sure you know as well, plenty of people who voted for Obama more than once and then went for Trump. I mean, this is happening all over the country. By the way, this is not just, I should say, it's not just happening all over the country. It's happening all over the world. All over the Western world, parties of the left are dispirited. They don't know what they believe in anymore. You know, they talk about, you know, innovation and creativity and the creative class, globalization.
Contempt.
Oh, yeah. And don't get me started on that, but give me a second here. But all over the world, working class people are deserting these parties and turning to people like Trump, you know, Marine Le Pen or Geert Wilders.
Who ended up not winning in the Netherlands.
Yeah, I know, but the copycat people did win.
Let me take a call here to Jesse in Lakeville. Hey, Jesse, hi. Thanks so much for waiting. I know you called even before the show started, so I appreciate that.
Well, yeah, it's a great topic, Carrie, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Frank, I wish you lived in Minneapolis. I'd say let's go get about 10 beers and solve the world's problems today because you're reading right from most of our scripts. I can't wait to read the book. Bottom line, I want to give you just my background. I grew up, never voted Democrat until 2008. Agree with you 100% about Obama. I grew up in very much of a household that embodies the Trump psyche. The people who voted for Trump, that's a lot of my family members. And I don't hold it against them, to be honest, because I agree with what you're saying. There was no party representing them. It doesn't look good. But this is one thing. To answer your question, Carrie, is that what does the Democratic Party do? Well, just listen to Bernie Sanders. Look at what he's done. He's got a movement happening here that I've never seen in my lifetime. I'm 41. I've never seen anything like this. Just listen to him. Let him lead. Get out of the way. And you'll then make his success yours. And number two, that activism that's happening right now is really encouraging. Yes, our worst nightmare came true. Trump and the Republicans took over. But I've never been more politically active. I use there's a phone app called Five Calls. It gives you a script and people to call about certain topics you're interested in, and it couldn't make it easier.
That's interesting.
It's a great thing. And yeah, I can't wait to read your book. But yeah, I would say I'm probably going to be the first one to say it, and you're going to hear this name over and over again, Bernie Sanders.
All right. Awesome.
Get out of the
way. Wait a minute. Bernie Sanders is the answer? Talk about
can I just say this about Bernie Sanders? So I wrote a story for I voted for Sanders in the primary. I interviewed Bernie Sanders for Salon.com a couple years ago.
But he's the answer to these woes that you're talking about that the Democrats
I would say that he is pointing us in the right direction. But I did a story. Can I just say something about Bernie Sanders? So 5 years ago, Bernie Sanders, like I say, I live in Washington D.C. Bernie Sanders was regarded in Washington as a marginal figure. As a crank, as this strange wild man from from Vermont. Today he is the most popular politician in America, and that tells you something. So a while ago, I wrote a story for Harp last year. It all seems like it seems like so long ago now. I wrote a story for Harper's Magazine about the Washington Post's war on Bernie Sanders. This was really interesting, and I read every op-ed and editorial that the Washington Post ran from January to June of 2016 during the Democratic primaries that mentioned Sanders. I read them all, and of course they were massively against Sanders. It was something like 5-1. They really disliked this guy, but they didn't just dislike him; they hated this guy, and they wouldn't. I mean, they would not give
him
a break.
You mean their editorial board or their
both editorial board and
reporters.
I didn't know. This is not news stories. This is op-ed.
All
page.
Editorial.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So that's – I mean, I think that's more fair, you know, than trying to find a bias in a news story, just to read the op-eds and see what they say. And they hated this man really profoundly, and that was interesting to me for a bunch of different reasons. I tried to understand why that is. And one of the reasons that I came up with – well, the most obvious one is what I'll mention first, which is – that these op-ed columnists and the members of the editorial board are from the class that I describe in Listen Liberal, the sort of affluent white-collar professional class. And they felt a kinship with Hillary Clinton and with the sort of upper echelons of the Democratic Party. And not just a kinship, an identification. These are people at the height of their profession, and they see the sort of the people at the top of the Democratic Party as very much their people. And they see Bernie Sanders as a kind of, you know, an interloper. But he also – there's another thing about him. And this is even more interesting, I think, is that he represents the politics of the past, that the Democratic Party and a lot of the sort of pundit class in Washington, D.C. believes that they have put behind them forever. He represents – I mean what Bernie Sanders was selling was like the Democratic Party platform from 1948. You know, it's not radical
but
stuff.
But here's the other thing.
But it's the return of the repressed. You see what I'm saying?
But the other – yes. But the other thing is that I don't think it's all that unusual when I hear people say, you know, I could have voted for Sanders in the end. Obviously, he wasn't on the ticket in the end, and I voted for Trump. I mean, in some ways
– yeah, I've heard that. It's amazing.
But – in some ways, what Sanders was selling, as you put it, were a lot of policies that probably also, just as with President Trump, would have been impossible to enact. Free college, some of the other stuff that he talked about just was not going to happen.
Well, maybe. But the whole thing, you toss
that off like who cares?
Well, look, ideology is important, too. Setting a direction, having goals.
Enacting it's pretty important, too, for the voters that have expectations. But
what about what I just said? What about the goals?
I mean,
a party should have goals. You know, the four freedoms. No, we never achieved that. But, you know, it's on, you know, you inscribe it on a statue in the park. You know, it's something that we believe in very deeply, very profoundly. I mean, parties have platforms.
But isn't part of the reason that you were disappointed with President Obama because he did not enact a lot of the change that you wanted him to enact? Could Sanders have done it?
Well, look, so Obama was in a unique situation in 2009 with the bailouts. Obama had seats on the board of every Wall Street bank. Obama could have fired all the top management on Wall Street. He did fire the CEO of General Motors, remember. It was totally within his power at the time. That's gone. To do what Sanders wanted, you'd either have to enact a provision of Dodd-Frank, which it would be very complicated and messy, or you would have to pass new legislation, a new Glass-Steagall Act. And specifically on the banks, but I'm saying overall, a lot of what he talked about
would have been almost impossible. And I don't see all that much difference between the way he talked about his goals and ideology from how Trump talked about it. Some of it would have been
very easy to get done. For example, renegotiating NAFTA. By the way, this is another part of the guilty conscience of the Democratic Party. Because they, of course, got NAFTA passed over the incredible opposition of their own base, you know, the labor movement. They did it. Something I learned from a debate between Obama and Hillary Clinton in 2008, where both of them were promising to renegotiate NAFTA. And they pointed out that the president can unilaterally withdraw from NAFTA. There's what they call an escape hatch. I don't know if Trump is aware of this. Let's not tell him.
There's a Times story this morning on the front page. Did you see this?
Getting out of NAFTA or dealing with NAFTA may
end up being his next Obamacare.
It doesn't necessarily require Congress to do it. That's the thing. It would require Congress to do a new trade deal with these countries. The problem with Trump is that it's not clear to me he knows what he's talking about. You know, with Sanders, I had considerably more confidence that he had studied the issue, you know, and read, you know, books and magazine articles about it. With Trump, I don't feel that way.
Thomas Frank is here. If you've just tuned in the studio, we're talking about some of the ideas that he writes about in his new book, Listen Liberal, and in some of the columns that he's been writing about. I'll tweet out the link to this column in The Guardian that we started out discussing. I want to hear from you this morning as you hear us talk about what's lacking in the Democratic Party. If you're a Democrat or an independent, what kind of change do you think has to be made within the party to refocus it and reinvigorate it. Are you concerned that opposing Donald Trump is really the reason for being now for the Democrats, and it distracts them from really taking stock and doing the hard work of creating a new, a renewed vision? 800-242-2828-651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Michael in Minneapolis. Hey, Michael. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, Carrie.
Hi.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be on. So I want to just first reiterate that the importance of state legislatures cannot be undersold. It is vitally important. I remember hearing somewhere that they are the most representative and most able to actually enact legislatures, going back to, you know, the deadlock Congress of the later Obama years. But to answer your question directly, mm-hmm. it's incredibly easy to take the NRA model of just saying no, of basing an identity around the rejection of an idea. You know, look at what Trump did with Obama, and I think in a lot of ways Democratic Party is able to be successful by just saying that they want to oppose
okay.
Trump.
So you feel like that's enough of a...
I don't.
...of a purpose?
Okay. It's enough to galvanize people, and it's enough to mobilize support on the ground. But I think it all goes back to what Lincoln said about a house divided cannot stand. If you have the two parts of the Democratic Party... The one, I believe the term was Enron Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are,
again,
you know,
what an awesome phrase,
right? The white collar, you know, quote unquote liberal elite, they're bankrolling the party. And, you know, the more you get into politics, the more you are able to fund these kinds of politicians, the more voice you have, I think, is the unfortunate truth. And you have, you know, just to reiterate your last caller, the emergence of someone like Bernie Sanders, who is essentially the polar opposite of a Hillary Clinton, you know, now the most popular politician in the country. But before even the Democratic nomination came out, there was polling that suggested that Hillary could not beat Trump, but Bernie could. And I think the reason for that is the populist support that is behind him.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Bernie appeals to a lot of the, as we've mentioned earlier, appeals to a lot of the same voters that deserted the Democratic Party for for Donald Trump. Only he does so without the, you know, the toxic baggage, the bigotry and the anti-Muslim stuff, and, you know, all the stuff that goes along with Donald Trump. But Bernie appeals to a lot. So I've been on a speaking tour of the Midwest, and I've been speaking in union halls, among other places, and you will often, these people love Bernie Sanders. I mean, love him. And this is the demographic group that
Bernie
deserted
Sanders
for Trump.
Bernie Sanders is the future of the Democratic Party.
Well, he's a little old for that, of course.
Exactly.
But I would say, but Bernie has this, I mean, we're getting back to this, into this subject, but his following among the millennials, among the kids, is an amazing thing to behold. And they definitely are the future of the Democratic Party. But these are kids coming out of college. You got to remember that when we talk about inequality and everything that is going wrong for the middle class these days, these are kids who are living it. You know, they go to these universities that are massively expensive. They take out all of these student loans these days. They come out into the world. The economy has been essentially Uberized, you know, casualized. And they are incredibly bitter. I mean, they can see that the life that people my age enjoyed, or that people my dad's age enjoyed, is simply not going to be available to them, you know. And they are mad as hell. And I mean, it's like the new proletariat, sort of. And that is the future of the Democratic Party. But what the caller was saying about the Democrats, you know, coming together to oppose Trump, this is both obviously what has to happen, but it's also in some ways a danger. And what I mean by that is that after a debacle like this, there has to be accountability. And there, if you ask me, there has to be accountability. You know, I study history. That's what I do. There has to be accountability for mistakes going back years and years mm-hmm. and years. The Democratic Party needs to change course. It's not enough to just say no to Trump. And can I keep going on this? Because there's something very interesting here.
Yes.
Trumpism is not going away. Trump himself might be defeated. You know, 2 years from now, the Democrats in this the great revulsion against Donald Trump that's going on right now
may win the House.
Yeah, they might. They might win something back. They might even win the presidency in 4 years. But the Republicans have learned something in 2016, which is how you beat this. You know, how you beat the Democratic Party. How, you know, he did something that that Mitt Romney and John McCain could not do, and they're never. And he did it, by the way, despite the most incredible series of scandals and blunders I have ever seen in American politics. Look, the Republican Party is never walking away from Trumpism. The Democrats can't just sit back and say we're going. This is all going to disappear on its own. It's not.
So I want to be clear about. I mean, you've just noted what an imperfect messenger he was for Trumpism, right? So let's separate him, the person, from the idea of Trumpism, which is what and why are you so convinced it's so resilient?
Populist nationalism. So he took your traditional Republican, bill of goods and added to it. He's opposed. He's against free trade. He will preserve Social Security and Medicare. And these are they seem like small adjustments, but in fact, for Republicans are huge. Right. The Koch brothers are deeply angry about this stuff that he's against, that he's turned the Republican Party against free trade. That is, if you ask me, trade was the winner. That was the issue that really hurt Hillary Clinton. Look, the Republican Party is never going back from this.
Okay,
they're never
retreating. So the Republicans have learned specifically
they've learned how to win. Yeah.
On trade.
Or some other populist issue. But basically, he has taken the sort of – the Republicans have been heading in a populist direction for a long time, going back to Reagan, going back to Nixon. Trump has taken this much farther than anyone, you know, than anyone expected. And they have figured out this is how you win.
Judy says on Twitter, your cynicism – about Bernie equals Dems' attitudes of crying in their soup. If Bernie had won, he would have brought other Democrats with him. And another listener says, great discussion. People want straight talkers. With that, they apparently tolerate and accept the difficulties enacting plans. To the phones to Elizabeth in St. Paul. Hey, Elizabeth. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Apologize for the cold.
Go ahead.
But I really think Democrats need to build up and support people in unions and union members. I'm in a union. I'm a teacher. But for years, Republicans have been saying they're bad and they're destroying them. But the people don't get mad at Republicans. They get mad instead at union people, the rights we have and the things we have. People just should not be destroying unions. We should be building them up. We should be making them better, and Democrats need to support them boldly and proudly.
Hear, hear. Agreed. People should have the right to bargain collectively with their boss. There is no doubt in my mind, and they should have the right for a free speech at work and all of those things. And it's unions that secure those rights. Now, we all know the story that the Democratic Party and unions were very closely identified beginning in the 1930s, very closely identified. And the story of Listen Liberal is how that alliance came apart, how the Democrats turned against their allies, former allies in organized labor. And it began after the Vietnam War in the late 1960s and kept progressing. Sort of the high point in that was I mentioned NAFTA earlier, where Bill Clinton, who had just in 1992 had just got elected with the enormous help and assistance of organized labor, turned around and put the knife right into their back with NAFTA. You know, this is something that they deeply resented and hated. And by the way, they're bitter about this to this day. But this is an interesting thing. It didn't just insult organized labor. NAFTA really hurt them. It hurt their ability to organize. It hurt their ability to bargain. To make any kind of headway against management, because it gave management this incredible tool. You know, they can move over. They can move to Mexico whenever they want. But by the way, this continues to this day. The unions are the Democrats won't give them the time. I was at the Democratic convention in Philadelphia last summer, and the first day of the convention was the union day, and all these national union leaders got to give their speeches, and then we all go out into the parking lot and we're supposed to take Ubers back to our hotel because the Democrats had struck a deal with Uber. It's like, who are these people?
You're not
what party
stop
is
that,
this
though, right?
Stop what?
Stop the sharing economy. Stop what's happening. What did you?
I'd like
you
to unionize it. I think it should be organized.
No,
you had
a really interesting phrase for it at the beginning of our
Uberized,
conversation.
Uberized, or casualized. But
yes,
look,
the whole thing about
the sharing economy, and as with so many of the innovations of our time, innovation, right? So many of these innovations are all about circumventing.
What do you have against innovation?
Oh, it's just a cliche. It's the great stupid cliche of our time, that and creativity.
Why?
Because they are. Have you ever heard the phrase "creative class"?
Of course.
The idea that creativity is the province
Richard
of a class.
Florida from
wait, but think about it.
Who is based in Toronto?
He
writes
sat in this very chair, I'm sure.
Yes, he has.
The idea that creativity is the property of a class. And that the our national policy – and by the way, the same class that I'm talking about, the affluent white – they don't mean people like me. I ran a literary magazine, right? I write essays. I am not – or my friends who are musicians, we are symbols of creativity. But the creative class itself is professionals if you read – you know, if you read the creative class theory. Every Democratic governor, mayor, you know, elected official thinks that the way to prosperity is to flatter this class – to reorganize the life of your city so that this class feels at home, to write trade deals so that the creative class can make a killing with Big Pharma, whatever the hell it is, you know, wherever. And they identify things like Wall Street as part of the creative class because, right, they're coming up with the, you know, financial innovation.
I have to say, I've never heard Richard Florida refer to Wall Street as part of the creative class.
Well, you can go back and read in the aughts. The financial innovation is the key phrase here. So mortgage-backed securities were widely regarded as financial innovation. Wall Street was widely celebrated for its innovativeness and its creativity, coming up with all of these, you know, slicing and dicing risk, coming up with all of these things. You can find it. And the, you know, Wall Street is – the Democrats look at Wall Street and they see exactly the kind of industry that they want us to respect. You know, this it's filled with these creative individuals. It has this wonderful jargon. It's so sophisticated. It's the people they went to college with, the people they went to graduate school with.
I mean, I do not hear people like Cory Booker, Kamala Harris hold up Wall Street
as
the vision of
– It's toxic, but I'll give you an example that will shock you.
Okay.
Barack Obama, the man we hired to get tough with Wall Street in 2008. He was doing an exit interview with Fortune magazine 3 months before the election where they're asking what he'd like to do.
Before 2016?
Yeah. What he'd like to do in his post-presidency. And he listed a bunch of things, and one of them was venture capital. Barack Obama wants to go into venture capital. These, you know, if you change the phrase, if you change the wording a little bit, or you were at the Democratic convention last summer, the Wall Street people were everywhere. They're all sitting in the skyboxes. You don't get to mingle with them, but they're, you know, they're all over the place. This is the Democratic Party. And look at Hillary Clinton herself. You know, her relationship with Goldman Sachs is alternately legendary or notorious, depending on how you look
at it. American voters didn't mind it all that much because they signed for Trump.
Yeah,
talk about relationships
with
Wall Street. It doesn't
We didn't know that at the time.
Look at who he's filled his administration with.
I know. So you get it. It's like
I'm saying
we were joking about this last night.
This
it's
might
like,
bug
get...
you, but I don't know how much it bugs the average American voter.
Oh, enormously.
Really?
People hate
Wall
Street.
Well, then why'd they sign? Really?
Yeah.
Then why'd they sign on for Trump?
Because he doesn't care. Well, he didn't. Wait, during the campaign, he denounced Wall Street all the time. Do you remember at the Republican convention when Ted Cruz got booed off the stage? Do you remember this moment? And his wife, his poor wife, Heidi, is there in the audience. And they booed her out of the arena, too.
Because
and you know how they booed her?
For
Goldman.
Was it Goldman Sachs?
She worked for Goldman. They taunted her with – they were chanting, Goldman Sachs, Goldman's. It was cruel. It was – I mean, one of the meanest things I've ever seen. But it was their hostility and their identification of Hillary with Wall Street. Trump did it in every speech. Now then, of course, he's a complete hypocrite, becomes president, and does exactly the same thing. But yes, he rode that. He took that right to the bank. That is, there's no question about that.
I have to get a newscast in here. Thomas Frank is with us in the studio. We're talking about some of the ideas at the center of his new book, Listen Liberal, and some of the other writing that he does. I promise we will get to more calls, but we'll get a look at the latest news here. Hey, Phil. Hi.
Hi, Carrie. France's foreign minister is calling for an emergency UN Security Council meeting over a suspected chemical attack in Syria's rebel-held Idlib province. The minister condemned the atrocious act in a statement saying he is seeking the emergency meeting because of events of extreme gravity that threaten international security. Russian investigators have identified a 22-year-old Kyrgyz-born man as the suicide bomber in Monday's blast on the St. Petersburg subway. The investigative committee says the man set off a bomb on a train that killed 14 people and wounded dozens. Senate Republicans and Democrats are ready to commence a floor debate on whether to confirm President Trump's pick for the Supreme Court, and they are headed toward a showdown over longstanding rules of the Senate. President Trump meets this week with Chinese President Xi Jinping. The first face-to-face discussions between the two leaders take place Thursday and Friday at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. Some view the informal venue as a sign that neither side anticipates important outcomes. President Trump meets Wednesday with Jordan's King Abdullah. There are questions as to whether the meeting can lead to the restarting of stalled Israeli-Palestinian talks. At a summit last week, Arab leaders renewed an offer they made in 2002, recognition of Israel by Arab nations in exchange for the creation of a Palestinian state. And White House officials hope to resuscitate failed health care bill. They are offering a chance, a change in hopes of winning support from conservatives who helped derail it. Vice President Mike Pence and two top White House officials met late yesterday with members of the House Freedom Caucus. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:42.
Hey, if you've been catching Indivisible, our national call-in show for the first 100 days of Donald Trump, you hear me host the show from Minnesota Public Radio on Thursday nights. Last Thursday, how faith shapes political identity. If you missed it, you can find it on the Indivisible Radio podcast. Just search for it wherever you get your podcasts.
Programming supported by the Guthrie's World Stage Series, presenting Peter Brook's Battlefield. Based on the Mahabharata, this critically acclaimed production explores the immeasurable costs of victory after war. 11 performances only, beginning April 13th. Tickets at GuthrieTheater.org.
Back to our conversation now with Thomas Frank, the author of Listen Liberal, and to the phones to Ed in Brainerd. Hey, Ed, hi. Thanks so much for waiting. Good to have you.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling from a part of the state that is most certainly, well, Trump country in the last election.
Right.
And I think Mr. Frank is dead on a couple points. I mean, I voted for Obama, and I certainly voted for Hillary Clinton over the alternative. But Sanders was certainly my first pick, and I think the party has missed out on populism. An example, one aspect of the financial crisis happened a lot around here. Huge wave of foreclosures, tons of people losing their homes. Generally, working class, lower income, some in the middle class. A great opportunity to really reform the financial services industry, require banks to reduce the amount owing on mortgages, let people stay in their homes. Instead, Obama did basically a partnership. We'll have a partnership with the banks. The banks will do these loan modifications. Government will give them a whole bunch of money. What happened in practice? Almost none of the loan modifications work. I do lots of bankruptcy work. I see this all the time. They'd give people a trial of 3 months trial, so they get their money from the government. Then they'd lose the paperwork. Something happened.
So, Ed, forgive me for interrupting. We have a lot of people that want to get on. You believe that it was the Obama administration's policy on the housing meltdown, and you agree with Thomas Frank about how he aligned too closely with the banks. Is that right?
Definitely. That was one example. I mean, there's others, and I give Obama credit for some things he did, but that was one example. People hate banks around here. I know tons of people who voted for Trump. They hate banks, and if the Democrats had delivered something on the banks, something that benefited people, let people stay in their homes, help people out with the ridiculous interest rates they're paying.
Okay.
Would have been a great opportunity. A lot of those people were lost to Trump instead.
Okay. Thanks very much. And let me go to Pat in Champlin. Hey, Pat, hi. Thank you for waiting.
Hi.
What are you thinking
hi.
About?
Well, first of all, I've read Mr. Frank's book, loved it. Look forward to what he has coming out next.
Signed copies at Majors and Quinn, by the way, Pat.
Yeah, that's right.
He suggested that I say. You were going to add.
Okay, I'm a 58-year-old lifelong Democrat and didn't vote for Hillary this year. I did it knowing that in Minnesota I had the privilege of not having to vote for Hillary because as a state we are so strongly Democratic. But I was so frustrated with the Democrats and my super elected superdelegates who absolutely refused to listen to their electorate. I'm now at the point looking at the upcoming elections with our senators, and I don't want to vote for them. And I'm trying to figure out how do I get past this, and can I trust them to listen to the electorates? And I'd be interested to hear what Mr. Frank has to say with it, with his historical background.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, okay. So the we're all frustrated with the Democratic Party, and there obviously has to be accountability within the Democratic Party, and there has to be a change in the way the party approaches. I mean, just listen to what the callers have been saying. Everybody is furious about this. And by the way, you can see this all over the country, these people who disappointed with the Obama administration. In some ways, Trump is one of the legacies of Obama, in a kind of weird topsy-turvy way. The question is, what do you do about it? Do you organize within the Democratic Party or do you go to some kind of third party movement? And what I have discovered in my reading of history is that third party movements don't work anymore. They did once upon a time in America, but the laws have been changed and deliberately changed to make it well nigh impossible for a third party movement to really challenge one of the two major parties from top to bottom. You'll have people that run for president like Ross Perot, Ralph Nader or something like that. But it's extremely difficult to build a real third party. Now, there has been a lot of success over the years with people challenging within one of the two major parties. I mean, look at what Bernie Sanders did. This is an incredible – this is a hopeful story. He did with almost nothing. He ran his campaign on a shoestring and came very close to defeating the most powerful political machine in the world, the Clintons. Donald Trump did defeat the Clinton machine, and by the way, he did it spending half as much money as Hillary Clinton did, which is one of the most amazing statistics to come out of the last election. So, there is hope out there. I mean, it's not always about the money. Money doesn't always prevail. So that's my little ray of hope. That's my sunshine for the day.
Pat says on Twitter, this guy is nonsense. The creative class is born out of technological advancement. What does he want us to do? Stamp out fenders?
I'm sorry, I don't understand that. The creative class is born out of technological advancement. It's always defined as the professional class, almost always. That would include, by the way, a lot of Silicon Valley and stuff like that. But that's simply how it's defined. People who do office work, that sort of thing.
I think Pat is saying this is where the economy
of course. Yes, I mean, we're in the information age. Sure, of course. I understand that. The question then is, whose side are you on? Are you on the side of the winners, or are you on the side of, of ordinary people who are watching their way of life be destroyed? And the Democratic Party, by and large, chose 20 or 30 years ago, seeing that this change was happening, chose to side with the winners in the new economy, who they call the creative class or the learning class. They have all these different terms for them, the wired workers. That's the question. There's no doubt that that's the age that we're in. By the way, there is manufacturing in the world today. I don't know. People often don't seem to understand this, but I was just in Sweden.
What do you mean they don't understand that?
She said, we don't stamp out fenders anymore. Well, somebody does. There is manufacturing. It still exists. It tends to be very high tech,
Yeah.
I was just in Sweden. They do it all the time. In Germany, they do it all the time.
Isn't that precisely the issue with the jobs that may come back in manufacturing in this country, that they're going to be extremely high tech? And the people those jobs, would it?
Sure, why not?
If they're high tech,
they train
robots
people to do it,
can do them, right?
Well, no. Robots tend to be the more the simpler tasks.
Well, have you seen the numbers on what happens when you in-source jobs?
Yes.
And how many
Carrie,
jobs
you're getting
end up
into
being
a subject
available.
That I know something about, and you're gonna wind up taking up another hour here. But listen to me. Productivity.
Thank you for that warning. You're right.
Productivity growth has always been considered a good thing, and now I look around, and this has just started in the last 6 months. Everybody's saying, productivity growth is so scary and dangerous. No, productivity growth is a fine thing. When productivity goes up, wages go up.
I'm just saying that you're very concerned for the workers of America.
Oh, of course I am,
and when we insource jobs,
yeah,
they tend to
be awesome.
Okay, it's going to be awesome. Let's see. Another listener here says, what's with Frank's contempt for identity politics when basically he practices putting white, mostly labor, as most important?
I haven't said anything about identity politics.
Do you have anything against identity politics?
Of course not. I'm very liberal. I'm liberal across the board.
Seriously. I think we could have guessed that from the conversation.
Yeah.
Let me go to Jane in Lanesboro. Hey, Jane, thank you for waiting. What are you thinking about?
Hi.
Hi.
So I live out in rural Minnesota, but I also check off all the boxes in that. I live 30 years in Minneapolis. I'm a professor, so I guess I got a lot of viewpoint. But living out here now in rural Minnesota, I feel like the Democratic Party has turned their backs on rural America, and that's been a big problem. And what I see as being the most helpful for rural America is some sort of many types of legislation that would promote smaller farms and smaller businesses. Because
Excellent.
Our small towns are dying because small business can't survive anymore in America. And small towns used to be supported by multiple, many, many small farmers. And now we don't have many small farmers.
Okay.
But
this
our
is a,
legislation.
This is another one of my favorite
Jane,
subjects, by the way.
Yeah, go ahead. Uh-oh.
You remember another What's the Matter with Kansas? It was all about this stuff. But I recently wrote a story for The Guardian about small town Missouri. And this is an area that was – and by the way, this you see the same thing in small town Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa. A lot of these people in a lot of these areas went for Obama in 08, like enthusiastically for Obama in 08, and now went for Trump by these enormous margins in small town America. It's like something you've never seen. I was out in small town Missouri, counties that went for Trump by 70%, 80%. And by the way, these are people that were Democrats once, but not just they were profoundly Democratic. These are people that like have shrines to Harry Truman in their homes. Right. And it's not like they've become prosperous all of a sudden and that's why they're voting Republican. As the caller said, small town America is falling apart. I mean, the buildings are falling down. And so you ask, what could Democrats do for these people? And what did Obama promise them in 08 that they thought was so great? And it's the answer is so obvious. And yet we never talk about it. Antitrust. Exactly like the caller said, family farmers these days are being absolutely choked by these enormous agricultural combinations and monopolies, and everybody in farm country knows it. Obama promised to get tough with them in 08 and then simply didn't deliver, just dropped it like a hot potato. And these are people who have gone from hope to desperation.
So given that we're almost at the end of our conversation, which are there some Democratic leaders besides Bernie Sanders who you invest a fair amount of optimism in?
A big fan of Elizabeth Warren. I like Keith Ellison, who's from right here in Minnesota.
Not running the DNC.
No, but he's a man I admire. He is the future of the Democratic Party, really. He's very, very – he's a thoughtful man. He's a capable person. I like Sherrod Brown from Ohio. There's lots of good Democrats out there, mm-hmm. Lots of people that I don't include – that I exempt from my criticism.
From the Enron Democrats?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you feel like the party has begun that – accountability process that we talked about at the beginning of the conversation, or do you think
not really? No,
because opposing Trump is so all-consuming and satisfying.
If you turn on your MSNBC or open up your New York Times, all they talk about is that the Russians stole this election from us, which is such a cop out. I mean, there's some truth to it, of course, but it's just an excuse. And they are using this to silence any criticism of themselves. Look, it has to happen. There has to be a process
but
of accountability.
But what's the impetus to make that happen, do you think?
Failure.
I mean, yeah. Not winning back the House
in
2018?
Yeah, I know, but sometimes I think, you know, look, I've been arguing this and talking about this for a long time. It's not like any of the issues that I've described are secrets or difficult to come up with or difficult, like antitrust or some of the Bernie issues or anything. These things are not hard to understand. The Democratic Party simply isn't interested in them. And I sometimes think they would rather if winning means getting on board with those issues, they would rather lose.
Good to have you here. Thank
you. It's my pleasure. I love the Twin Cities.
Thank you. Thomas Frank's book is called Listen Liberal. Yeah, you can find signed copies at a certain bookstore in Minneapolis. Thanks.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.